Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain and I'm sick to death of being joined by Peter Hart.
I'm not surprised, Gary. I'll become like a limpet mine.
Yes, well, just a limpet, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, today we're continuing with our Air War Over the Somme series, Pete.
What number are we on now?
I think this is the fifth one, I think.
Wow.
It's called Tide Turning on the Somme.
I think I may have misunderstood the whole thing. This is the air war, not the sea war, but there you go. Now, where are we? Well, towards the end of the summer of 1916... British efforts, they're aiming at the old third line, the old German third line system. And it's what would become, it's preparations for what would be called the Battle of Flers-Courcelette, which, of course, as you know, Gary, was starting on the 15th of September. What's going on? What do I mean, preparations? What are they doing?
Well, there'd been continuous small-scale attacks over the previous 2 months, and it had moved the British line forward less than a mile on a front of just 3 miles wide. And listen to this, Pete, at a cost of some 82,000 casualties. Now, that in itself was worse than the results achieved on the 1st of July.
Yeah, Pryor and Wilson have explored this in their book on the Somme. Small scale attacks, just a battalion going over, isolation. But now there's going to be an all out assault. And who's joining them? That's often forgotten, although we do remember that podcast we did on the French on the Somme. Who's joining them?
The French. You just said the French.
I've rather given it away, didn't I?
Yeah. I couldn't get a word in edgeways, eh?
It's not like you.
Now, the intention was a decisive breakthrough to exploit the painful wearing out process.
I'm worn out here.
Now, unfortunately, the Royal Flying Corps preparations for the offensive coincided with the return to the Western Front of the incomparable Oswald Bolker.
Who's he then?
He's a German.
A German. He's the other German ace. Immermann.
There was Immermann, who by this stage was dead, wasn't he?
He was, and that's why Bolker had been sent on his holidays to have a look around the Eastern Front, the air war on the Eastern Front. And he came back on the 27th of August, 1916, and he'd come back and he formed his own scout squadron, Jaster 2, which was based at Bertincourt. He's not a fool, is he? I mean, unlike some people, he said, gazing just over the settee at him.
No. I mean, he thought deeply about the theory and practice of aerial warfare. He wasn't the only one.
No. He was, in a sense,
the first. Probably
the first.
Yeah. And the principles have been recorded in slightly varying forms ever since. But in essence, they were as follows. And we'll alternate with this, I think.
Yeah, right. Who's going first?
I'll go first. So, number one was to try to secure advantages before attacking. If possible, keep the sun behind you.
Ooh, beware the Hun in the sun, Gary. Always carry through an attack once you've started it. Yeah?
Yeah. Number three, fire only at close range and only when your opponent is properly in your sights.
Yeah, number four, always keep your eye on your opponent and never let yourself be deceived by ruses.
Well. Five, in any form of attack, it's essential to assail your opponent from behind. Have you been assailed from behind?
Not recently, no. Number six, if your opponent dives on you, do not try and evade his onslaught, but fly to meet it.
I'm not saying anything after that one. Number seven, when over the enemy's lines, never forget your own line of retreat. Oh, that's very important.
Yeah, obviously, because it's not a suicide mission, or it's not meant to be. Number eight, for the staffel or the squadron, attack on principle in groups of four or six. When the fight breaks up into a series of single combats, take care that several do not go for one opponent. And these, what does this bring to mind in your head?
Well, it's very similar to Manic, isn't it?
Manic, yeah, a year later, though. But yeah,
always
Manic,
from above, never from beneath.
Yeah, that's right. Come from out of cloud, come from the sun, come from an air, the way you're not expecting, i.e. the German side of the lines for Manic.
Yeah, yeah.
Very similar to Richthofen, but of course... Richthofen,
but very different to Albert Ball.
Yes.
Who was described as a berserker, I think. A
barnstormer, yeah. Charge!
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, these rules... They were a code for effective air fighting with an emphasis on achieving the best possible results, but also living to fight another day.
Yeah, they're not earth-shatteringly original. We've talked about the British were edging their way. But anyway, Jasta II pilots, amongst them, we've already mentioned him a little bit, but who's one of the Jasta II pilots that would become rather better known?
Oh, well, it's Manfred von Richthofen.
Is he the evil Baron von Manfred?
Well, depends on your perspective. Born in 1892 of an aristocratic family, Richthofen had a keen interest in hunting, which he was soon to take to new heights.
That's a terrible pun, I've just realized.
Yes. Early in the war, he served as a cavalryman, before in 1915 a desire for excitement caused him to gravitate into the German air service. Now, Bulker obviously saw potential in the young aristocratic sportsman because he invited him to join his new squadron, and therefore Richthofen joined Jasta II.
And there were some other good pilots amongst them, but let's move on. We've got to realise that Jasta II doesn't immediately end British aerial domination, which had been established on the Somme. For a start, his squadron hadn't been yet equipped with aircraft, and a lot of his pilots were novices. They were hand-picked, but they were novices. It's like when I remember when we started these podcasts.
I was hand-picked.
You were hand-picked. You were more plucked than hand-picked.
That's true.
And now look at you, a fully responsible and a historian with considerable stature.
Now, changing the subject back, he himself, that'll be Bulker, made occasional sorties, but the British continued to ply their trade with relative impunity. And therefore, on the 6th of September, 27 Squadron Royal Flying Corps carried out an effective raid on a railway station far, far behind the German lines.
Far,
far away. And this is, I love this name, this is Lieutenant Hugh Chance.
Huge.
Of 27 Squadron Royal Flying Corps. And this is what Hugh says. We had a good show the other day, £812 and £36.20, or thereabouts, on a big station about 50 miles behind the lines. We came down to about 500 feet and fairly buggered the place up.
Technical term.
Trains flying miles in the air. One chap dropped his 112 on a turntable and all the slates on the engine sheds around it leapt about 6 feet into the air. Huns bolted out of the station like rabbits. They exceeded all speed limits and had colossal vertical breeze. We got machine gun and rifle fire, but no damage done and all got back safely. I'd like to know a little bit more about him. There's a humour in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Too late for our book.
Yes.
Laugh or fly.
Oh, I see what you've done there.
Advertising. Now, British have aerial dominance, but if you were unlucky enough to meet Bulker, Oswald Bulker, you were in a spot of bother because he's like a single-handed attempt to stem the British tide at this point. But it's a overall, it's all still going well, isn't it? The unsung heroes of the artillery observation and photographic reconnaissance, the BE-2C crews, they're all carrying on their work, aren't they? They're doing everything you'd expect.
Yeah, because the importance of spotting German batteries and accurately directing the counter-battery fire had now been fully realised, and there was no chance of either aircraft or guns assigned to the task being distracted.
And that's a move forward, because one of the problems on the 1st of July is they hadn't really concentrated enough on taking out German artillery. Now, well, let's do an example. We can only give examples, can't we? So here's an example. On 12th of September, Lieutenant Horridge, Leslie Horridge, same name as my dad, well, Leslie's his name.
I was going to say, I didn't know your dad was called Horridge.
And 2nd Lieutenant Scott, that's a great name, wish I was called Scott. They were on artillery observation above Pozières when they were surprised by a German scout. The emotion's welling up here. Although the B-2C could never be called, you know, it's not an effective fighting aeroplane, is it? They managed a bit of a triumph here against all the odds. And this is what Les to his friends. This is what Leslie Horridge said. I'm not his friend. He's 7 Squadron. I had a little excitement yesterday morning and my identity disc nearly came in useful. I was doing artillery work just this side of the lines at about 2,000 feet. My observer, Scott, was doing his first shoot. I wonder if that's Scott and a disastrous misprint. Was doing his first shoot. And was just sending down a message when a Hun came from behind a cloud about 100 yards away at the same height and began firing at us. We were broadside on and he was slightly behind us. I could not make out where the sound was coming from for a second or two, and when I saw him, I dived steeply. At the same time, Scott turned round and opened fire over the tail. It was the first time he had fired from an aeroplane and he was awfully good. About 10 seconds after the scrap began, Scott got him with his third burst and brought him down in flames. We were then 700 feet up, about a mile this side of the lines. He dropped like a stone blazing. I have never been so frightened in my life before. I could not see the Hun, and when he stopped firing, I thought that he had had enough and was going back, but Scott's face suddenly brightened up and he pointed behind. I looked behind just in time to see the machine flare up after it had crashed. Some excitement. And that expression, some, that's the, it's a verbal tic that you find in a lot of things. There were some this, some that, and hence the book I wrote, which you might remember.
Some success. Now, Horridge and Scott, and I think it is Scott because it's repeated it about 19 times, had not escaped unscathed from the doomed German pilot who put two bullets through their engine, and they had problems during the return flight.
Now, I can imagine two bullets through the engine would about give you a spot of bother.
The work was seemingly endless and the core aircraft were constantly in the air. As the mass bombardment prior to the September offensive opened, they could see the results of their efforts. And once more, you're going to tell us what Lieutenant Leslie Horridge of 7 Squadron says.
We have been very busy lately. I was up for over 6 hours yesterday. This is the most I've ever done in one day. When it was getting dark in the evening, I saw one of the biggest bombardments of the war. I could see the guns flashing on a front of about 12 miles. It was one continual flicker. How anyone could live down below, I can't imagine. Wow.
Now, the core aircraft knew what lay ahead of them, and as ever, they were determined not to let the infantry down in any way. The Battle of Flers-Courcelette was intended to capture the German third line from Morval to Le Sars. The blood, sweat and tears of the previous 2 months had achieved a start line close enough to the old German third line to offer some chance of success. But, of course, the Germans, they'd not been idle.
Now, so there's no longer the old green fields, if you like, behind the third line. There's just three fully-fledged trench systems now behind them. Now, they're not the sort of formidable trench lines and redoubts and concrete fortifications that have faced the Fourth Army on the 1st of July. I mean, a lot of the trenches just chains of shell holes almost linked together, but there are still three lines in front of them, three systems as well. But there's one slight tinge of hope for the British. What is it?
Well, I think it's the unveiling of the new secret weapon.
Ooh.
The tank.
Oh.
Now, that offered
is
them,
that all?
That offered them some hope of loosening the strangulating grip of trench warfare. But the early tanks, they were slow, prone to breakdown at the drop of a hat, and of course, none of their crews had battle experience in their new ironclads, not to mention the conditions inside.
Yeah, yeah, it's hell on earth inside there. The artillery barrage is still the absolute key to success. And before the 15th of September, the first two German trench systems are pounded all along a 9,000-yard front that was going to be assaulted. Although they don't quite get as good as... Remember that fantastic attack on the 14th of July, there was a step forward. They don't quite get to the intensity of that. But it is much, much better than had been achieved on the 1st of July. Trenchard briefs his officers. He goes around the squadrons, briefing them and telling them what is expected of the Royal Flying Corps in the battle to come. And we've got a witness to this, and he's a fabulous witness. He's a humorous chap, just like yourself, Gary. This Lieutenant Alan Bott, Bott by name, Bott by nature, of 70 Squadron Royal Flying Corps. What does he say?
On the afternoon of September 14th, all the officers of our aerodrome were summoned to an empty shed. There we found our own particular general, who said more to the point in 5 minutes than the rumourists had said in 5 weeks. There was to be a grand attack next morning. The immediate objectives were not distant, but their gain would be of enormous value. Every atom of energy must be concentrated on the task. It was hoped that an element of surprise would be on our side, helped by a new engine of war, christened the tank. The nature of this strange animal, male and female, the difference was the male had 2 6-pounders, I think, and the female had 2 Vickers water-cooled machine guns, I think. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I digressed.
You digress.
The nature of this strange animal, male and female, was then explained. Next came an exposition of the part allotted to the flying corps. No German machines could be allowed near enough to the lines for any observation. We must shoot all Hun machines at sight and give them no rest. Our bombers should make life a burden on the enemy lines of communication. Infantry and transport were to be worried, whenever possible, by machine gun fire from above. Machines would be detailed for contact work with our infantry. Reconnaissance jobs were to be completed at all costs if there seemed the slightest chance of bringing back useful information.
So it was, 06:20 on the morning of 15th September, the infantry go over the top. Now, once again, we've got a witness, and that's Lieutenant Cecil Lewis, the great Cecil Lewis of 3 Squadron at this time, RFC. And he's up on a contact patrol, and he says this. There was a half-hour hurricane bombardment, and then the tanks were put over. From the air at about 5,000 or 6,000 feet behind the lines, watching the whole scene, there was a solid grey wall carpet of shell bursts. But it was just as if somebody had taken his finger in the snow and pulled it through the snow and left a sort of ribbon. There were 4 or 5 of these ribbons between Fricourt and Boiselle and running back towards High Wood. That's gaps in the bombardment left for the tanks. Through these lanes at 0 hour, we saw the tanks begin to lumber. They'd been cleared for the tanks to come in file. They came up 3 or 4 in file, one behind the other. Of course, they were utterly unexpected. That's by the Germans. The first lot went sailing over the trenches, and we thought, well, this is fine, because the whole thing was the year was getting a bit late. If we don't get through now, we never shall. This was a great opportunity, and hope was high. We thought, if they can get through the third line defences, we can put the cavalry through and the whole war will become mobile again. And so we watched pretty carefully to see how things went. By this time, all the area had been shelled for the best part of 3 months. It was continuous shell holes for miles and miles. The ground looked from above like a pockmarked skin. All the trees had been shot. There was no greenery. There was nothing. Except amongst the grey wool of shell bursts, these lumbering chaps, or tanks. One or two of them with red petrol tanks on their back. One even had a little mascot, a little fox terrier running behind the tank. They couldn't hear it from the aeroplane. Then one would stop, and we had no idea why. Obviously it had been hit, or somebody had thrown a grenade at it, or it had had a breakdown. At the end of 2 hours, they had moved about a mile, and we thought everything was going well, and we came back because our petrol was finished. And that gives an idea. I mean, the tanks basically failed that day. They showed some potential. A lot of crises they just broke. Most of them broke down. Some of them shot their own men because it's a terribly confusing environment in a tank. But there was the one that got through Gerdecourt to, you know, Flares Courcelette towards Gerdecourt. It wasn't a big success, but it was a sign, wasn't it? Now, who else is up that day?
Well, Lieutenant Albert Ball, he went on several missions, and he had a brisk but deadly meeting with five Roland two-seaters. That's the one known as the Whale, I think, the Roland.
You are the international expert on German aircraft.
And this is Lieutenant Albert Ball of 60 Squadron. Five Rolands seen over Belpalm in formation. Newport dived and fired rockets in order to break up the formation. Formation was lost at once. Newport chased the nearest machine and got under it, firing one drum at 20 yards. Hostile aircraft went down, quite out of control, and crashed northeast of Bertincourt. That's now, very matter-of-fact, isn't it?
Well, he is a matter-of-fact chap at most times. He'd been on a patrol. He'd been intending to attack German kite balloons, the observation balloons. He was armed with incendiary Le Prieur rockets. They were on his wing struts and they could be fired by an electric switch to bring down the balloons. But he used these from this time on for quite a while to break up German formations, aircraft formations, because you'd see the rocket whizzing amongst them and they'd all break up and things. Quite imaginative. But it's also not entirely legal, I think, in the rules of war, but there you go.
Now, on the ground, the Battle of Flares Courcelette could hardly be called a pushover. Because there were severe problems with surviving German machine guns, especially in those shell-free lanes, as it were, in the creeping barrage left for the tanks to advance. The infantry were left badly exposed in these lanes whenever the tanks broke down or were held up, as was frequently the case.
Now, they'd improved with counter-battery work, but when we say improved, that's improved from a low level. So there was still plenty of German artillery undisturbed, and they flayed the British in their jumping-off positions and caught them in no man's land and continue to be a bloody nuisance. There's still not enough British guns devoted to a counter-battery fire. It's just such a huge, huge task, and they don't really get a grip to it till late in 17. The result was what? What were the casualties like?
They were appalling, nearly 30,000. In total, that is.
Yeah. The German frontline positions were taken all along the front, and they even took 4,500 yards of the new second line around Flares. That's where the tanks did best, I think, although they did well on where the Canadians were. So there you go. During this period, this is where I often get... even more purpley prose than usual. The German line has been bent, bashed, reshaped, bitten into, but it retains its overall integrity. In other words, there's no breakthrough.
That sounds like me when I bit that officer.
Yes, your integrity was bad. Yes.
Now, the morale of the defending troops was dented, but it endured.
You were dented after buying
this. Yes. German manpower reserves were stretched, but still the reserve divisions moved forward to counterattack, obstruct, and eventually once more halt the British advance. Now, during the battle, the Royal Flying Corps broke new records for the amount of hours flown and the intensity of the aerial fighting. The contact patrols, artillery observation work, deep searching reconnaissance patrols, bombing raids, all covered by the aggressive posture of the scouts seeking out their prey.
Wow. The aerial operations in early September, and at this point, this battle, the 15th September, it's like the median point before the pendulum. Median point? What is a median point? Anyway, it's the swing point. It's where the pendulum of aerial warfare starts to swing back decisively towards the Germans. Why is that? Why?
Well, just a few days later, the changing pattern of the aerial conflict was painfully apparent.
Was it?
The impetus for change was the delivery on the 16th of September of the Albatross D1, earmarked for Bulker's Jester 2. Now, although new German scouts such as the Fokker D2 and the Halberstadt D2 had been arriving on the front throughout the summer of 1916, they all had only one fixed forward firing machine gun. The Albatross D1 was the first scout to be armed with twin Spandau machine guns firing through the propeller,
through
or rather
it.
Around it, or through the gaps.
Around the carry.
Without a corresponding loss in aerial performance due to its careful streamlining and the awesome power of its 160 horsepower Mercedes engine, which took it up to speeds of nearly 110 miles per hour.
It's better than any Allied scout flying on the Western Front at that time. And it has a sleek... When you look at pictures of it, perhaps we'll remember, perhaps we'll not.
Put a picture up.
We'll probably forget. But it had a almost stream... To the modern eye, not, but then streamlined appearance.
Yes, and unlike the Roland called the Whale, this one was nicknamed the Shark.
Are sharks more dangerous than whales?
They are.
Depends whether they
Balker sit on was delighted with his new machines. Now, we're in for a real treat here.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're going to tell us what Captain Oswald Balker of Jasta 2 says.
Yesterday, at least six arrived, so that I shall be able to take off with my Staffel for the first time today. Hitherto, I have generally flown Fokker biplanes, but today I shall take up one of the new Albatrosses. My pilots are all passionately of French. Are all passionately keen and very competent, but I must first train them to steady teamwork. They are at present rather like young puppies in their zeal to achieve something.
Well, that day, untrained or not, the puppies were to leave their mark on the battlefield. And at this point, to get over it, frankly, we'll take a short break. On the 17th of September, the B-2Cs of 12 Squadron were ordered to bomb the Marcoing Railway Junction line just to the south of Cambrai. They were escorted by the FE-2Bs of 11 Squadron, led by Captain Gray. However, they ran into pilots from Jasta 2. And once more, you're going to treat us to Captain Oswald Balker.
This morning, I ran into enemy squadron with two of my pilots, Lieutenants Reimann and Richthofen. We cleaned them up thoroughly. Each of us got one. I engaged the leader's machine, which I recognised by its streamers, and forced it down. My opponent landed at Equincourt and promptly set fire to his machine. The inmates were taken prisoner. One of them was slightly wounded. The pilot had to land because I shot his engine to pieces.
I didn't know Balker was a pirate. I thought he was a pilot.
Oh, I may have misheard.
Now, alongside Balker was Lieutenant von Richthofen, who was desperate, almost obsessive, in his desire and determination to shoot down his first victim. But he's also inexperienced. Now, nevertheless, he managed to get behind the FE-2B, crewed by the veterans, Lieutenant Lionel Morris and Lieutenant Tom Rees. And this is what he says. The Englishman nearest to me was travelling in a large machine painted in dark colours. I did not reflect very long, but took my aim and shot. He also fired, and so did I, and both of us missed our aim. A struggle began, and the great point for me was to get to the rear of the fellow. Apparently, he was no beginner, for he knew exactly that his last hour had arrived at that moment. I got at the back of him. At that time, I had not yet the conviction he must fall, which I have now on such occasions. But on the contrary, I was curious to see whether he would fall. My Englishman twisted and turned, flying in zigzags. At last, a favourable moment arrived. My opponent had apparently lost sight of me. Instead of twisting and turning, he flew straight along. In a fraction of a second, I was at his back with my excellent machine. I gave a short burst of shots with my machine gun. I had gone so close that I was afraid I might dash into the Englishman. Suddenly, I nearly yelled with joy, for the propeller of the enemy machine had stopped turning. Hurrah! I had shot his engine to pieces. The enemy was compelled to land, for it was impossible for him to reach his own lines. The English machine was swinging curiously to and fro. Probably something had happened to the pilot. The observer was no longer visible.
I find that somewhat chilling. Probably something had happened. They were both killed. They were both killed, both Lionel Rees and the other chap. Lionel Morris and Tom Rees. He's so keen that he gets his angle of attack wrong and nearly runs into the back of them. That's the truth of it.
Now, the Albatross totally outclassed the FE2Bs and gave them a margin of error that more than compensated for any lack of combat skills. It allowed the fledgling German pilots to prosper and take their kills almost at will. As you mentioned, Richthofen's first victims crashed into the ground at Villers-Pluich, I think that's how it's said. And he was on his way to becoming the greatest scourge of the Royal Flying Corps.
He was indeed. And now Bulker, he's pleased with his young pilots, but he still knows they've got a lot to learn before they can take on, for instance, the better German British scouts, the DH2s and the Nieuports. Because although the Albatross was better, that it wasn't as much better. That you had to know what you were doing. And this is what Captain Oswald Bulker says. I have to give my pilots some training. That is not so simple because they are all inspired with such fiery zeal that it is often difficult to put the brake on them. They have certainly all learnt that the main thing is to get the enemy in your power and beat him down at once instead of arguing with him. But until I get it into their heads that everything depends on sticking together through thick and thin... Oh, Churchill. When the staff goes into battle, and that it does not matter who actually scores the victory as long as the staffel wins it. Well, I can talk myself silly, and sometimes I have to turn my heavy batteries onto them. I always give them some instruction before we take off and deal out severe criticism after every flight and especially after every fight, but they take it all very willingly.
Yes, I can see there being some complaints after this.
What do you mean, some? You mean more?
Now, gradually, the British found that everything was becoming much harder. Thus, on the 22nd of September, No. 4 Squadron Royal Flying Corps was ordered to attack the German observation kite balloons. And you're working very hard today. You're now going to be, and this could be interesting, Lieutenant Francis Cave of 4 Squadron. He's British.
Yeah, right. In the morning, Scott told us that we were going to be balloon strafing in future with phosphorus bombs. Carol and I did it this afternoon. There were 6 of us in all and 5 de Havillands. They made a splendid burst and probably doing anything near them. After dropping mine, I missed the others and suddenly found a Hun diving on my tail. He was very fast and practically had me on toast as I only had a forward mounting. He held his fire until about 20 yards away and then circled about, firing from all directions. I got into a spinning nosedive and temporarily lost control of the machine. Eventually, I got it out and got behind him and let him have about 15 rounds right into him, causing him to nosedive, but probably under control. I then made straight for home. I had absolutely given up all hope of living through it, or at any rate of landing this side of the lines.
Now, after the Battle of Thurs-Courcelette on the 15th of September, the 4th Army had wanted to launch the next assault as soon as possible. Unfortunately, the inevitable delays caused by moving forward the guns, coupled with an unfortunate break in the weather, led to the attack being postponed until the 25th of September.
There's more tactical advances in. The British Army is learning. Unfortunately, the German Army is learning as well. We've talked about the Big Dipper, the twin Big Dippers before. Things... You know, one thing. So now the British, they're limiting objectives to just the German front line. That's their original third line back in 1st of July. And that increases the density of shells falling onto the German frontline garrison. The augmented creeping barrages are being developed more and more. In the counter-battery work, some 124 German batteries are located by the RFC and other sources. Of these, the gunners managed to engage 47 and silence 21. What does that mean, maths? With Pete and Gary?
47, 21. That meant 103 were still in action.
Yeah, so that's most of them.
Yes.
And that's the point. Does that mean that they've done a bad job? No, they've done as best they can, but there's more resources needed, aren't there?
When the Battle of Morvale was launched on the 25th of September, the results were impressive. The British troops struck close behind the mangling curtain of detonating shells that guided them forward across no man's land and hit the German survivors before they had a chance to think or do anything.
Now, as another development, Gary, I should have mentioned, sorry, I'll drop it in here. They also now had the plan of a concentrated fire of some 60 field guns, which was formed at a barrage of shells in front of the captured ground, which shattered the German counterattack that was launched next day. This idea of a wall of shells in front of captured positions is taking hold, and that's going to be a vital part of bite and hold in the part of 1917. Well, what do you think of the whole situation?
Well, overall, lessons are slowly being learned, although it's important to recognise the two steps forward, one step backwards nature of tactical thinking. Every battle had different features, and it was therefore difficult for the senior commanders to separate the effects of special circumstances from the results of the application of sound tactical principles. So you sort of get red herrings abounding in the fog of war, and that was very real over the Somme.
Now, on 26th of September, the focus of the Battle of the Somme starts to shift to the northern Somme sector. Now, originally, they were in a holding role, but the reserve army under General Sir Hubert Gough, that is gradually becoming more active. They're renamed the 5th Army, isn't it? What had been happening in their sector? Well, in July, there'd been severe fighting to capture the village of Villers, and they'd been grinding their way up onto Pozières Ridge. And then once they got Pozières Ridge, and this whole thing is a drama in itself, they then aimed their attacks towards the German garrison on the Thiepval Ridge. So what happens?
Well, finally, on the 26th of September, the time was considered ripe for a final assault to be made to pinch out the Thiepval thorn in the British side. Here, too, new tactics were tried with mortars.
More new tactics?
Yeah, mortars were used to fire gas shells, and for the first time, massed Vickers machine guns fired indirectly over the German front line onto the rear areas to complement the artillery barrage.
Wow. So things are moving.
That is clever.
It is.
Now, still, there were problems, and heavy casualties occurred when the infantry were unable to keep up with the creeping barrage during the bitter fighting in Thiepval itself. Nevertheless, the village fell, together with several neighbouring strong points, leaving Gough's army safely ensconced on the Thiepval Ridge, overlooking the German trenches in the Eynker Valley to the north.
Now, let's have a look at what... So, the fighting's boiling up again on the ground. What's happening in the air? What's happening to Albert Ball? Yeah, that's you. What's happening to you?
He's still alive.
That's actually quite surprising. Yeah,
and he's still causing mayhem amongst the Germans. His Nieuport 17 was not as fast or powerfully armed as the Albatross D1, you made reference to that earlier, but it had a tighter turning circle and was more agile in close combat.
Yeah, it's inferior. It is inferior, but in the hands of a skilled pilot and operator like Ball, it can hold its own. Now, his combat reports, their combat reports are not, you know, you're not writing them to your mum, are you? They're in a dry and personal language, but and in a sense, they conceal rather than illustrate what must have been incredibly dramatic events. So let's have an example. 21st of September, Ball runs into a formation of 6 Roland scouts. What does he say?
Hostile aircraft, we'll call them HA, seen north of Belpalme in formation. Nieuport dived and fired rockets. Formation was lost. Nieuport got underneath nearest machine and fired a drum. HA dived and landed near railway. Nieuport then attacked another machine and fired 2 drums from underneath. HA went down and was seen to crash at side of railway. After this, the rest of the HA followed Nieuport towards the lines. Nieuport turned and fired remainder of ammunition, after which it returned to aerodrome for more. Second machine was seen to crash by Lieutenant Waters.
So it's all in the third person, isn't it? Because Nieuport is Albert Ball. Fantastic. Let's have another one. Now, we're talking about an ace. We're talking about a fighter, a scout pilot. But remember what we've said. What's really important is the core aircraft. But this is a hero at work. So let's follow him. Just two days later, 23rd of September, he's in the thick of it again. Now, this time he's got the new Buckingham Tracer incendiary ammunition. Again, I'm not quite
sure. That's the balloons, isn't it? Yeah,
The Germans don't like it. I know that. What does he say? He's still with 6th Squadron. What does he say?
4 Rowlands were seen coming from Cambrai towards Moree. Nieuport got behind them and fired a drum at 30 yards range. This made them separate. Newport then made for the nearest machine and got underneath it, firing one drum. This drum had no effect on the HA, for Newport could not get near enough. Newport then made for another and succeeded in getting within 15 yards underneath, at which range 90 rounds of 1-in-3 Buckingham were fired. HA was on fire before 15 rounds were fired, but it was observed to go out before crashing on the ground near Moree. The remainder of the HA surrounded the Newport after this, for it had no ammunition. Newport only got 13 hits on its planes.
Surrounded by German...
Only got 13 hits
in the wingy things, yeah. Oh, dear. Now, same day, Gary, he's in action again. It's another desperate tussle, if you like. By this time, it's interesting. He's got a Lewis gun fitted with the double drums of ammunition, which, how many rounds would that be?
Oh, dear.
Is it 82? I'll never... Is it 41? Why can we never remember how many rounds in a Lewis gun? Anyway.
Well, we'll put it up.
No, we bloody won't.
Of course we won't. And this is, once more, Lieutenant Albert Ball. Newport could not see any HA over Belle Palm at a reasonable height, so it went along the Cambrai Road. After being there for a few minutes, two formations came along. Newport attacked the first. The HA ran with noses down, but when another formation came near, it turned towards the Newport. Newport fired one drum to scatter formation, after which it turned to change drums. One of the drums dropped into the rudder control, and for a few seconds Newport was out of control. Newport succeeded in getting drum on gun and attacked an albatross which was then flying at its side. Newport fired 90 rounds of 1-in-3 Buckingham at about 15 yards range underneath HA. HA went down, quite out of control, and crashed. The remainder of HA followed Newport, but in the end left. In order to keep them off at safe range, Newport kept turning towards them. Each time this was done, HA made off with noses down.
He's an absolute hero. I mean, he's barking mad, but he's an absolute hero. He's not the only one doing this, because just as he's preying on the Germans, Bolker is meeting out punishment to the Royal Flying Corps. Got an example of this on 27th of September, Bolker leads an attack on six Martin sides of 27 Squadron over Bapaume. He's the leader of the formation, and he just makes it all better. And this is what he says. "We had climbed to their height and cut them off. I gave the signal to attack, and the fun started. It was a mighty scrap. I got to grips with one and blasted him properly, but came up too close and had to pass out below him. Then I went into a turn, in the course of which I saw the Englishman go down and fall like a sack somewhere near Air Villas. I engaged another immediately. There were plenty of them. He tried to get away from me, but it did not avail him. I hung on close behind all the time. Yet I was surprised at this opponent's tenacity. I thought I really must have settled him some time before, but he kept on flying round and round in the same sort of circles. At last I could stand it no longer. I said to myself that the man must be dead, and the controls are jammed so as to keep the machine in a normal position. So I flew quite close up to him, and then I saw the man sprawling over in the cockpit, dead. I left the machine to its fate." And stupid accents besides, it makes you think that that poor guy's just dead, and his aircraft's flying round and round in circles.
Yeah, we do know who he was. It was Second Lieutenant Dendrino flying the Martin side, and he'd obviously lapsed into unconsciousness from the effects of his wounds. He did die shortly after crashing behind the German lines.
Poor sod. I mean, you've got a feel for these chaps. Sorry about the stupid accent. Now I should not have done that, but there you go.
By this time, Richthofen was also beginning to score regularly in his own right.
I'm sure you're going to learn from my chasing.
And this is Lieutenant Manfred von Richthofen of Jaster 2. "He plunged down in flames. One's heart beats faster if the opponent, whose face one has just seen, plunges burning from 4,000 metres. Arriving below, I found very little remaining of either the man or the machine. I took a small piece of the insignia from this one as a souvenir. I had taken the machine gun from my second also to keep as a souvenir. It had a bullet of mine in the bolt, which rendered it useless.
Now, he was famous for taking souvenirs. There's a famous picture of his bedroom where he's got all...
All up on the wall, yes, I've seen that.
All the aircraft numbers and machine guns and things. And he made little cups after a while for himself, for a while anyway, till he got too many, he couldn't afford it.
So by this stage, the pendulum had clearly swung back to the Germans. Second Lieutenant Edmund Lewis was one who recognised that the situation had changed, but he was a philosophical young man.
Like myself.
And that's why you're going to tell us what Second Lieutenant Edmund Lewis of 24 Squadron says.
It rather feeds you up to see all this newspaper talk about our supremacy in the air. We certainly had it last June, July and August. But we haven't got it now. The Huns still keep to their side of the line while we venture over their lines, but if they wished, they could sit over our airplanes with their fast machines and we could do nothing against them. Perhaps this is a bit of an exaggeration, as we would certainly fight them and not run away as they do, but I don't think the Hun is good enough to face equal numbers over our side, even if they have got better machines. What I mean is that a DH-2 is no longer attacking, but is fighting for its life against these fast Huns, and that at present we have only about half a dozen machines to cope with them. Thank the Lord they haven't got as many of these fast ones, and that given the equal numbers, our machines would still put up a good, very good, in fact, fight against them on account of superior guts. But I suppose war in the air will always be like that. First one side has the best machines and then the other. And the side which shows most guts all through will be the winners. At any rate, I hope new machines are coming out from our side. We can't rest as we are. Now, there's some truth in that, but the idea that the British have more guts than the Germans is just a fallacy. But of course he thinks that because he's in it. And it's part. That's your morale, is that you're better men, man for man, than the opposition. That's what you've got to believe, especially when your aircraft are becoming inferior. And I entirely understand it. And beneath that sort of bravado and sort of, oh, you've got more guts than them, he is right about the pendulum of aerial
war. It's your description of the twin roller coasters. You know, one's in the ascendancy and one's over the peak and then going down because the new aircraft have arrived. And he puts that quite clearly.
I think so.
Now, of course, Trenchard was quickly aware and also deeply concerned by the new situation.
Is he backed up? Does he have...
Haig backs his urgent request for an increase in new scout aircraft to counter the deadly Albatross. And this is what General Sir Douglas Haig, Commander-in-Chief, says. Throughout the last 3 months, the Royal Flying Corps in France has maintained such a measure of superiority over the enemy in the air that it has been enabled to render services of incalculable value. The result is that the enemy has made extraordinary efforts to increase the number and develop the speed and power of his fighting machines. He has unfortunately succeeded in doing so, and it is necessary to realise clearly and at once that we shall undoubtedly lose our superiority in the air if I am not provided at an early date with improved means of retaining it. The result of the advent of the enemy's improved machines has been a marked increase in the casualties suffered by the Royal Flying Corps. And though I do not anticipate losing our present predominance in the air for the next 3 or 4 months, the situation after that threatens to be very serious unless adequate steps to deal with it are taken at once.
Now, the problem is, we've discussed this before, when it comes to new aircraft, why can't you immediately produce a new aircraft? Why can't you immediately produce a new tube train or a train?
Well, you've got to place the orders. You've got to, you know, design them. You've got to manufacture them. You've got to test them. And then at some point, the logistics of delivery. So it's probably months and months.
And Haig is prodding. Anything. But it's going to take a while. And this is the seeds of a future tragedy, not only the rest of the Battle of Somme, but the tragedy of Bloody April and the Battle of of Arras, which we have already dealt with in a previous series of podcasts.
But both in the air and on the ground, the Battle of the Somme's reaching a crucial phase.
Who's going to win, Gary?
We'll find out next time.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, Pete.
Hey. Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support blah, us, blah, you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?